Cash's friends and family found themselves dealing with two people, and from day to day they never knew which one would appear. You never knew what he would be like at breakfast time, says Johnny Western, or even if there would be a breakfast. Saul Holliff remembers wonderful talks he and Cash had while driving back to Casita Springs from LAX, in which Cash showed a clear-headed approach and a deep understanding of himself, but the next day he'd behave as if the conversation had never happened. John R. Cash was one of the greatest human beings who ever walked on the face of this earth, says Marshall Grant, who was often the person left to pick up the pieces. But Johnny Cash was probably the greatest jerk that ever lived. He had become two different people. That's the way it was. You can't explain it any other way. He was one of the kindest human beings you could imagine, and then something would trigger him, and he'd come back in the room a totally different person. It would be a 180-degree change. His relationships with women only added to the confusion in his life. In 1962, the Carter sisters and Mother Maybelle joined the Johnny Cash Show, and he found himself attracted to June Carter. Like anyone at the top in country music or in any other field, he set out to conquer whatever he could conquer. If he had the chances, he took them, says Saul Holliff. I don't know of very many people either in country or any other field of music who remain chaste. June took an almost motherly role with Cash, ironing his shirts, pressing his trousers, and making sure he ate properly. She discovered his drug problem when she came in the dressing room after they'd played a show in Macon, Georgia, and caught him with a handful of Dexamil tablets. She then realized why he was always so intense, why he came off stage in a cold sweat, and why he drank so much liquid. She had noticed similar behavioral characteristics with Hank Williams when she and the Carter family had toured with him in the early 1950s. She resolved to stop Cash from going the same way as Hank. She tried talking to him, but to no avail. His determination to change, whether for his faith or his health, always gave way to his need for more drugs. She tried confiscating or hiding his stashes of pills, but somehow he always managed to find other supplies he had squirreled away. When doctors arrived backstage with a prescription he needed to stay awake during long drives, fight stage fright, or lose excess weight, she tried to head them off, but Cash always found another doctor in another town who'd oblige. June's partner in this cleanup operation was Marshall Grant. June and I were the only ones who cared about him as far as keeping him alive, he says. As far as everyone else was concerned, he was immortal. He wouldn't die. June and I have stayed up many a night just to keep in touch with him, to keep him alive and stop him from hurting anybody. She was an ally. We both fought hard. I don't know what we would have done without one another. I couldn't have done it by myself. She couldn't have done it by herself. We could barely do it together. When Johnny was on pills, all of his closest friends would become his worst enemies, and all of his worst enemies would become his closest friends. His worst enemies were the people who supplied him with the drugs. His closest friends were June and I. He came down on us heavier than everyone else combined because he knew that we were going to fight him tooth and nail to keep him off the drugs and keep him alive. Therefore, we became his enemies. Now, when he got straight, all of a sudden we would be his two best friends. That's the way it was. Within months of meeting, the relationship between June and Cash became a full-blown affair. Like Billie Jean, June was a woman who was perfectly at ease in the predominantly male world of music and had been married to a leading country performer. Both Johnny and June had as much to lose if news of their affair leaked out, so they were discreet about their movements, never staying in the same hotel rooms or allowing themselves to be photographed in amorous situations. They both knew that what they were getting into was potentially dangerous. June was married to Edwin Rip Nix, a garage and body shop owner from Madison, Tennessee, but they drifted apart almost as soon as they were married in 1957. Part of the reason was that she was away from home 25 days of each month. Cash had four young children and a wife, who had yet to hear of his extramarital liaisons. Vivian knew that things weren't going well with Cash, and she genuinely wanted to know what was wrong and what she could do to fix things. She poured her heart out in poems that pleaded with God to make things right between them. June felt her relationship with Cash was becoming too powerful to control. She had started writing songs with Merle Kilgore, who, as a writer, had recently enjoyed a big hit with Wolverton Mountain, recorded by Claude King. The first song he and June wrote together was Promised to John. I'm promised to John. Can't you see that I'm promised to John? Anita recorded it with Hank Snow on an album called Together Again. Then one day June came to me and told me that she was torn apart and just didn't know what to do, says Kilgore. She said, "That Johnny Cash is spooking me. I am so in love, I don't know what to do." I said, "Well, have you got any ideas for a song today?" Told me that a friend of hers had just got divorced and had written her a letter. She went in and got the letter and read it to me. It started, "I never want to fall in love again, blah, blah, blah." And then it said, "I hate love. Love is like a burning ring of fire." Another version of the story says that the phrase was found in a book of Elizabethan love poems. Kilgore liked the idea of a song that described passion as a ring of fire, especially as a commentary on what June was feeling at the time for Cash. But he knew that the title Ring of Fire had already been used by instrumentalist Duane Eddy and his band The Rebels on a 1961 single. Working for a company that owned the original publishing rights, he wanted to avoid any confusion and thus suggested Love's Burning Ring of Fire as a title. While they were writing, Anita Carter was preparing an album, Folk Songs Old and New, and asked June if she had any new material. June told her about Love's Burning Ring of Fire, giving her the impression that they'd completed the song, when the truth was they'd stalled halfway through. June had put in the word mire, and I had to ask her what a mire was, says Kilgore. She said, "You know, Kilgore, it's when you're stuck in the mud. Where I'm from, if you're mired, you're stuck." I said, "That's not romantic." I learned right then never to start polishing a song before it's finished because creativity goes right out the window. Because June had claimed they'd finished the song and Anita was ready to record, they had to complete it in a hurry the next day. "I started working on it," says Kilgore, "and when I got over to her house, we knocked that song out in 10 minutes, but the word mire was still in it." Anita's version, produced by Jerry Kennedy, was released in November of 1962, and Cash immediately liked it. To avoid damaging June's chances of success, he said he would give it 4 months before he did a cover version. In the meantime, he claimed that he had had a dream where he heard himself recording the song with trumpets, an unheard-of arrangement for country music at the time. The dream could have been suggested by something June said, because she based the tune on the swirling sound of music she once heard coming from a Tia Vivo, merry-go-round, in the town square of Villa Acuña, Mexico. Cash desperately needed a hit. Despite being a remarkably popular touring act and an instantly recognizable name in American pop music, he hadn't had a single in the pop charts in nearly 4 years. The Ways of a Woman in Love made the charts in October 1958. Only two of his last 12 singles had even punctured the top 100, and of his albums, only The Fabulous Johnny Cash made the top 20. Blood, Sweat, and Tears never climbed higher than 80. His voice was badly affected by his amphetamine use at this time, so he was finding it hard to get the right sound, says Kilgore. His records weren't selling and he was in bad shape. Columbia was concerned that he'd lost it all. If you don't have hit records, then you lose your audience. There's nothing like a hit to bring the people back. His producer, Don Law, was having an understandably hard time persuading Columbia and New York to keep investing in Cash. His contract, which had been renewed after 1 year in the middle of 1959, would expire at the end of 1963, and it was clear that if Cash didn't have a breakthrough hit in the next few months, they wouldn't renew him. One day, Kilgore mentioned over lunch with Jack Clement that Cash was having problems getting the right sound in the studio. Jack said, "I can get the sound back." I said, "Really? He's doing a song of ours called Ring of Fire. I wish there was a way that you could produce it." He said, "There's no way Columbia will let me anywhere near Johnny Cash. Don Law has an iron hand over him." Kilgore repeated this conversation to Cash, who said, "You know what, Merle? I know Jack Clement can get my sound back. When you said that, it put chills all over my body." Clement was living in Beaumont, Texas, where he was doing well for himself as a producer. He'd had a hit with Dickie Lee's Patches, had the publishing for George Jones's She Thinks I Still Care, and had written the follow-up The Girl I Used to Know. Clement recalls, "I was in the bathtub and Johnny called me and said that he wanted me to come to Nashville and help him produce this song that June Carter and Merle Kilgore had done. He told me he had had this dream about the song having trumpets on it. So I came to Nashville. We got a studio and hired two trumpet players. Don Law was a nice guy, but he had just sit around and do what he wanted to do. He was registered as the official producer, but I was the one who ran the session. I came in and told them to change microphones on the drums and told the horn players what to play. I hummed it, and they wrote it down. I played my guitar on it and led the band. I thought it all sounded pretty neat, but a few weeks later, when I kept hearing it played on the radio all the time, I thought, hey, that was good. Though the song was about a relationship, its central image was ambiguous. The fire was most obviously the heat of passion, but could also have referred to the dangerous nature of the particular liaison, or even to the fire of punishment. This latter interpretation gained strength from Cash's intonation of the phrase, down, 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 which seemed to indicate the fires of hell. The Mexican trumpet sound, unprecedented in country music at the time, added to the impression of heat and passion. Released in May 1963, Ring of Fire reached number 17 in the singles charts, and 2 months later, a Best Of album, also called Ring of Fire, reached number 26 in the album charts. For the time being, at least, Johnny Cash's recording career with Columbia was safe.